overflow rooms from which you can also follow the session on the screen if you can't find a place in here. It's a great pleasure to be with you for this session on male circumcision, to cut or not to cut. My name is Álvaro Bermejo, and I'm the Executive Director of the International HIV/AIDS Alliance. Unfortunately, my co-chair, Du Afan, has not been able to make it, so we are a co-chair and a speaker short. Manuel Belandia has not made it either. But I really hope that that will give us time to have more dialogue, questions, and answers, and be able to make it a little bit more interactive, even though that's not easy in this setting. Joining me here in the panel, we've got three distinguished speakers. Supreme is the communications officer for Engender Health in South Africa, where he has been working for the past 3 years on a program called Men as Partners, doing gender and HIV work. This program is focused on working with men to encourage behavior change of negative gender norms, destructive forms of masculinity, and to create more constructive male involvement on issues of fighting against HIV/AIDS and gender-based violence. Supreme is also a musician, and his musical and songwriting skills send positive messages around gender and HIV/AIDS prevention and management. He works with a group of artists in South Africa. He has been active in gender and human rights for about 7 years now. Next to Supreme is Marge Bearer. She is the founding editor of Reproductive Health Matters, a peer-reviewed journal that began in 1993. She has also been the chair of the International Consortium for Medical Abortion since 2002, and chair of Voice for Choice in London since 2007. She published a book on HIV and sexual and reproductive health and rights in 1993, and her journal has been publishing regularly on the intersection of these issues ever since. In 2006, her journal devoted a whole issue to condoms, and in 2007, half of an issue to male circumcision and HIV prevention. And finally, on the right is Karen Houston Smith. Karen is a U.S. national whose professional career has been spent in Southeast Asia, primarily in Indonesia, where she has spent the majority of her time since 1971. She was educated in the U.S. and Europe and holds a master's degree in education and social change from Harvard University. Throughout the years, much of her work has focused on issues related to participatory development with an emphasis on community empowerment, government-community cooperation, gender issues, and HIV/AIDS. She has worked for UN agencies, local community organizations, US-based NGOs, and the Indonesian government. She has just completed a 3-year assignment in one of the two easternmost provinces of Indonesia, where the place of male circumcision is part of a comprehensive response to HIV, and that has been the focus of recent discussion. In addition to chairing the session, I was asked by the organizers to introduce what we know about medical circumcision, about male circumcision, and as well as to raise some of the question marks and some of the concerns that then each of the speakers will develop further. Thank you. The International HIV/AIDS Alliance, an organization that works across 30 countries supporting community responses there, has had a very heated internal debate around male circumcision, and I think that is probably one of the reasons why they asked me to present this, because they knew how much debate and how much difficulties there was coming to grips with that. One of the things I found out in that debate was how few people have actually seen both circumcised and uncircumcised penises, so that which does help then in the discussion when you've seen both of them, which is why I wanted to start with this slide. But let me start by, why are we discussing this at this conference? Well, we're discussing it, and there have been many sessions on it, because we have come to the conclusion that two normative organizations, WHO and UNAIDS, have issued a statement highlighting that the efficacy of male circumcision in reducing female-to-male HIV transmission has now been proven beyond reasonable doubt, and a recommendation to countries with high HIV prevalence, generalized heterosexual HIV epidemics, and low male circumcision rates to consider implementing, or if they already have them, scaling up safe services as part of a comprehensive HIV prevention packages. This happened quite recently after the Toronto conference, and this is really the first conference where we're coming together to discuss this issue since the statement was issued. That's why we felt it was a great opportunity to hear the different views and perspectives at this session. Since this issue came out, there's programs have started on the ground, and here I wanted to show some of the messages that are circulating around to promote male circumcision programs. Again, for those of you that haven't seen it before, a slide here to show that, well, two things. One, that 30% of adult men around the world are circumcised and about 70% are not, and that there is a correlation geographically, as you can see here, between areas of high HIV prevalence and low prevalence of male circumcision. This is a slide, again, showing, well, you can see what it's showing. So what do we know? Well, we know, as I've shown, that the ecological data, the observational data, shows that prevalence of HIV in Africa is lower in countries where male circumcision is highly prevalent, over 80%. We have had three randomized trials in three African countries, South Africa, Kenya, and Uganda, that demonstrated reduced risk of female-to-male transmission by around 50 to 60%. And I want to highlight 2 points. One is that these are in high prevalence epidemics. So we do not know, we have not had conclusive evidence of significant protective effect for men in low prevalence settings. The other point I'd like to stress is what these studies show is that male circumcision reduces the probability of men getting infected, but it does not shield them. It does not fully protect from infection. And I think that's important for the discussion that'll follow. What else do we know for sure? That the risk of acquiring HIV increases in the immediate post-operative period, in the few weeks right after the operation. We're beginning to get some results, but we've still got few on the effects on sexual function and sexual satisfaction, and I'm sure that's going to be part of the debate today. The studies that have been done and the clinics in Southern Africa clearly show high levels of acceptability. That is, people responding orally that they would have male circumcision if that had a protective effect. We've also seen high uptake, which that is people not just saying that they would, but going to the clinics to have it. And there are lengthy waiting lists right now. We also know that there is no direct, and I emphasize the word direct, protection for women. However, mathematical models show that
the risk of HIV transmission would be lowered a decade or two down the road by reduced prevalence amongst men. We also know, as I was saying, there's high uptake that male circumcision might well bring many men into the local clinics. And if that is the case, it certainly should be coupled with other prevention methods, and there should be good advice and counseling. So that's, in a nutshell, what we know. What don't we really know? What needs more research? Well, we don't really have yet any capacity to measure the impact of large-scale rollout of male circumcision and look at the real impact on HIV prevalence. The effects might be different outside of the controlled research setting and the mathematical models that have been built around that research over a longer period of time. There's a question mark there around whether increased risk behavior following male circumcision would negate the protective effect that the clinical trials have shown. There might be what people call risk compensation. We also, because we're looking at a surgery that is, to a great extent, irreversible, we also don't really know yet how it will interact with novel prevention technologies that might come down the road and how that is factored into mathematical models when they look at the protective effect. And certainly the cost-effectiveness measures remain theoretical until we have large-scale implementation. And there are questions around whether, with limited resources, what will be the impact of male circumcision on already stretched health services and workforce. Will it be an intervention that strengthens those health services, or will it be an intervention that further weakens them? There have been a lot of controversy, a lot of challenges, and I guess that's why this room is so full. Clearly, we need to start from one point, which is that states, UNGAS, and many times since, have made important commitments to increasing the availability of HIV-related goods, services, and information. And these commitments and their fulfillment can be seen as part of the human rights obligations of these states. We also need to understand that meeting the demands for male circumcisions is not completely risk-free. The country where I'm working now, the UK, has clearly a statement from the British Medical Association that states it is now widely accepted that this surgical procedure has medical and psychological risks. That's the current position of the British Medical Association. There clearly is also a risk of message confusion eroding safe sex campaigns. So, well, if I'm circumcised, do I still need to use a condom type of thing? And there's also an issue. This is one of the very few prevention methodologies that clearly protects men in a different way and to a different degree than it protects women. So, will, as a result of male circumcision, circumcised men be more likely to blame their female partner if either of them becomes HIV infected? Some of the challenges that we have to deal with. Again, some slides, one to show also how some of the work is being disseminated. I particularly like this one. It's summertime, have your child circumcised. Additional controversies and challenges. Many people believe it causes a reduction in sexual sensation experienced by circumcised males. This is something very difficult to measure objectively, and I would say I haven't been able to see conclusive results that would support this, but clearly many people believe that. Some argue that male circumcision causes psychological trauma. Many others believe that the interest and the resources behind male circumcision is that it is being pushed as a medical, magical bullet at a time where we really needed something that could compensate for the limited success in the last 2 years of the research around microbicides and vaccines. And there are a lot of question marks around the extrapolation of male circumcisions to newborns, which raises lots of ethical and moral issues. So I'd like to finish here with this presentation of what we know, what we don't know, and giving some questions to the next panelists. And I'd like to thank Zeid Mirsi, sitting here in front, who manages a blog and a website on male circumcision, and who has been very helpful in putting this session together. Thank you.
I'd like to say greetings to all the wonderful people of the world gathered here today. And I would also like to thank the IAS for granting me the opportunity to render a presentation on how male circumcision affects young men and what it means for young men. Well, male circumcision has been practiced by humanity for millennia, and the practice has spread to many parts of the world. There's evidence of the presence of the practice found in Egypt as far back as 3000 BC. It is amazing that this practice has survived time and is still an issue in international platforms like this one. Well, based on already the findings that we looked at just now with Alvaro, now going forward, we need to look into what this means for us. And here are some of the issues that we would really need to take into consideration. The health system's preparedness to handle demand, cultural and religious implications, impact on gender norms and masculinity, behavioral change post-male circumcision, and possible gender-based violence increase, implications for women, issues of stigma and consent, communication strategies and guidelines. Now, an estimated 1.7 million HIV infections occurred during 2007 in Africa. And as we know that the sub-Saharan African region is the most affected area by the epidemic, it is important that countries within this region consider the rollout of MC as an additional prevention method. And as more information about the benefits of male circumcision goes out to the public, we see that the demand increases. And actually, at the moment, in some countries, you already find queues of men trying to actually access the services at health providers, and most of them are being turned back because of lack of capacity. Now, we will need a gender analysis in some of these places, and we'll need to draft detailed communication policies and strategies with clear guidelines on how we're going to be rolling out the process. And more training is needed for practitioners in order to ensure safety and reduce complications. Training of counselors is also required to improve the quality of counseling, which should be a component of male circumcision. More facilities will also be needed, and taking into consideration the rural areas, which already have limited existing health facilities and services. And MC will also have to be integrated with other prevention methods that are already existing in order to maximize effect. And I believe more funding will have to be allocated for groups that are actually working to transform gender norms and define new forms of masculinity. It's also important to make sure this service is safe, affordable, and accessible. This is of very importance to young men. And it's possible to explore ways in which the medical and the traditional sector can also work together to strengthen this practice. And policymakers and program developers will also have to monitor and evaluate programs in order to minimize potential harmful outcomes of promoting circumcision as an HIV prevention. And this leads me into looking into a very serious component of culture and religion and what circumcision means to young men belonging to these cultural groups and religious groups. Well, throughout the years, male circumcision has been an important part of culture and religion. And male circumcision is viewed as part of worship and keeping a covenant between humans and God. Circumcision takes place before the baby's eighth day, mostly within the Jewish faith, and it takes place within the ages of 10 and 12 within Muslim cultures. And some cultures, especially in Africa, equate the sacrifice of circumcision to the sacrifice of that women make when they lose their virginity, mostly after marriage. And MC is also seen as a form of blood sacrifice, which is offered to the ancestors, who are represented by the ground on which the circumcision blood falls. And circumcision, to a large extent, is seen as a part of a boy's rite of passage into manhood in many cultures, especially in Africa, where most of the cultures who practice this circumcise adolescent males. This forms part of a boy's socialization for their transition into manhood, emphasizing certain gender norms and ideas of masculinity. And circumcision is also seen as a way of enforcing masculine characteristics within males and limiting feminine characteristics, which are seen to be represented by the foreskin of the male's penis. And this also means that some communities that practice female circumcision, now called female genital mutilation, see it as the repression of masculine characteristics, which are actually represented by the female clitoris. And that's why some of the cultures would remove it. And it is clear that this has no benefits for women and rather poses a health risk. And many cultures who are actually circumcising adolescent males do not take kind to the possibility of alteration of their culture by medical circumcision and neonatal circumcision, because if the boy is circumcised while he's a baby, then what ritual will be performed when he reaches adolescence? And in many cultures, you're still viewed as a coward if you actually go to a clinic or a hospital to circumcise, because pain is actually part of the rite. And as we know that the medical sector actually is committed to pain reduction, if not the eradication of pain. So a lot of cultures do not see that very kindly. Within circumcising cultural groups, a lot of young males are actually isolated and discriminated if they are not circumcised the cultural way, and their families face a lot of shame and disgrace if they are unable to sort of persuade their sons to circumcise in this way. And if you're not circumcised in these cultures, you are called a boy, no matter how old you are, and you're not allowed to sit in gatherings where there's elders. And in some communities, your funeral will not even be announced by elderly men, will instead be announced by youth. And some cultures also associate circumcision with actually the foreskin with disease and lack of hygiene. And the foreskin is also associated to diseases that women who have sex with men who are uncircumcised will have. And while there's circumcising tribes in sub-Saharan Africa, there's also cultures that do not circumcise and sees it as a disgrace to have a member of their family circumcised. Just for example, the Zulus of Southern Africa. Within these cultures, a circumcised man is viewed as an incomplete man because of the missing foreskin, and it is also believed in these cultures that circumcision makes a man weak. And although some men within these cultures would like to circumcise for health reasons, they are unable to get support, and they find it very hard to inform their families. Now, the age of adolescence is an age where young people go through a lot of transition, both physical and mental, and there's a lot of pressures that take place during that time. And to many young men, traditional circumcision is still adds a greater pressure, because not all young men would like to go and circumcise, and actually a lot of them are scared of this practice because there's also mortality involved. During the month of June in my country of South Africa, 22 boys lost their lives in the former Transkei area, which is in the Eastern Cape region. And a lot of boys are still scared to go to the mountain, but they really have to go in order for them to be accepted as men. And though the government has actually set out an act to try to regulate traditional circumcision, a lot of non-compliance still leads to high mortality rates within the circumcising groups. And here's some of what young men actually might learn also at the circumcision schools, is that you have to be a man, you have to be strong, you don't have to cry, don't get help. And some of this other message is taught that you are superior to a woman and you have the right to have a lot of sexual partners. And some men also believe that, as I mentioned, pain is a serious, important part of this, so you need to feel pain, and that can also lead them to being violent many times. And another issue I would like to look at here is the implications for women, as women are also very much affected. Many times women are blamed for actually bringing the disease into the family, and women are mostly affected by HIV. And the resumption of sex after circumcision is another issue that puts women at risk. And I'd like to say that not all young men will resume sex after being circumcised. A great deal of men that I talk to in focus group sessions actually mentioned that they would obey the doctor's rule and actually sort of wait until they've healed. But in some traditional areas, this is very much encouraged. And as we know, women are also the caregivers a lot, so they have the burden of taking care of some of these men as well. And another issue is there's a lot of stigma around this, and as I said, women are seen as transmitters, and uncircumcised men can further experience a lot of discrimination, and as they're seen not to be men in these societies. And HIV-positive men who are unable to circumcise due to their compromised immune system might also actually receive a lot of discrimination. And some of the challenges is that many young men actually believe that this affects your pleasure and sensitivity, and also causes psychological trauma. And some men might have a false sense of security and think it offers full protection. And these complications also lead to male circumcision, as it's a surgical operation. And I won't go through all of these challenges, but my recommendations would be that MC should be part of a greater SRH package, and gender transformative approaches are needed to challenge harmful ideas of masculinity. And we need further research into how MC will affect men's behavior post-op and outside of the research environment. And more consultations with traditional leaders and communities are very important in rolling out this process. And clear and simple messages, which are straightforward, are needed to actually make sure that people do not misinterpret these messages. And my conclusion is that MC has created an opportunity to, for the first time, really focus on male sexuality, and MC could really prove effective if the medical world and the traditional world works together, and we should take all issues into consideration when we communicate this. I thank you.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, friends. All of us have come to inquire, and I'd like to try to add some grist to the mill on our topic of to cut or not to cut this morning. Specifically, I've been asked to talk about religious and cultural sensitivities. We've had some very, very helpful information from Supreme before I spoke, which obviously is in the same field, but I will proceed with the more general framework that I had prepared. I've divided my talk into three parts. First, I have a brief introduction. Second, with reference to religious and cultural sensitivities, I'm focusing my comments primarily on why do these sensitivities matter and how one can work with them. In part three, I return to our title, to cut or not to cut, and I will share some conclusions. There are various different ways that this topic could be put together. I will be presenting today very much coming out of my experience as a practitioner, development manager of various different kinds of support, various different kinds of activity. And on the other hand, bearing in mind the fact that we have all gathered this week to think, among other things, together, how can we lower the number of new HIV infections going forward? And it's in that context that we're talking about male circumcision. Let's consider, why do religious and cultural sensitivities matter? I'd like to suggest four issues which are particularly important to consider and I will give some illustrations thereafter. Let me introduce my 4 points first. Obviously, religious and cultural dictates, influence and control, either directly or indirectly, many aspects of daily life relevant to circumcision. For some people, it's every day, every activity. For many of us, it's only an echo further away, but it continues to have some impact. Second, the nature of the influence of religion and culture and our behavior based on them is very often location-specific, and therefore it calls for location-specific responses. Third, although religion and cultural prescriptions related to life often seem immutable, in fact, we know they can change. And there's often room for negotiation related to issues in daily life as they rise and set, for example, activity like circumcision, which may or may not be traditional. Fourth, understanding cultural and religious sensitivities is complicated because the interface of culture and religion with daily life often is at odds, so that in the end, doctrine and practice are not in harmony with each other. Let's look at the examples. In daily life, religious belief, cultural systems organize social relations, structure our value systems and norms. Historically, they've told us, for example, and we had some discussion of that earlier, who we could marry, how we would treat our bodies. They define gender behavior patterns and so forth. These are all issues that will influence attitudes to circumcision, and to a greater or lesser extent, they still influence public attitudes on many issues that are related. Secondly, these values and belief systems are, I said earlier, situation-specific, location-specific. For example, in Indonesia, as was mentioned earlier, most people associate circumcision with Muslim coming of age for young boys. Because of this, there are many Christians who feel that if they should decide they wanted to be circumcised, this casts some doubt on the validity of their Christianity. There are other people who, for their own purposes, have politicized the issue, and if someone is circumcised, turns it into an issue related to Islamization, which is not well accepted, forcing the religion on others in the community. On the other hand, in the Philippines, a country which is largely Christian, circumcision is common. It is seen, as we were told earlier, it is seen as a symbol of the covenant between man and God, and it is supported with references from the Bible. So that it depends completely, in this case, where one is, how that is seen. Values are changeable and sometimes negotiable. For example, we all know, and I say in quotes, we know, that the Catholic Church does not accept condoms. But in various areas, the one that I'm most familiar with at the moment, in eastern Indonesia, in Papua, 4 Catholic bishops have issued an instruction requiring the use of condoms if there is a married couple where one or both partners is infected with HIV. They discussed at some length, and they came to the conclusion that the church had no right to create obstacles for the members of the church who wanted to avoid transmission of infection to another person. They could not do that, and so they have said yes to the condom. Not only that they are accepting it, they have required it. But the pace of change obviously is uneven. Recent discussion with some Protestant ministers that I took part in, which was talking about circumcision. There were two ministers who were extremely positive, and there was an additional minister, a woman who after some time shook her head and she said, "Hey, all this time I've been struggling to come to terms with the condom, and now you bring me another issue. Now I have to start on circumcision." So change comes over time. It does not happen instantly. On the other hand, there are people, this woman is one of the leading theologians in Indonesia. She is also an AIDS activist. And through her work, a great many Protestant ministers have, on the other hand, become very active related to HIV and AIDS. The fourth point from my list above was saying that dealing with religious and cultural sensitivities can be complicated. Lack of congruence between values and action can be quite confusing. Working with these issues, we need to be alert to these kinds of differences. If we're not aware of the distinction, we can assume opposition or support when in fact there is none. And in the process, we lose allies. For example, when I mentioned previously with the condom, we assume Catholics are anti-condom. In fact, that's not always the case. So we need to be careful. In conclusion, I would come back to our theme, to cut or not to cut. I find the public health aspect, notwithstanding some of the uncertainties, I find the public health aspect is straightforward. We see that circumcision has a potential effect in reducing vulnerability to infection, and it should be, I would say, part of a comprehensive program if the cost-benefit side of it works out. At the same time, those of us who are involved and who are advocates need to work with public health authorities to assure desirable health outcomes. This issue was raised earlier again, and I underscore it. There is no point in moving forward on this if one cannot guarantee the health outcomes. What about the cultural religious sensitivities in this case? Having said yes, we think it is appropriate to move forward on integration of circumcision in a comprehensive package, then one needs to consider how the cultural and religious sensitivities can be addressed. I would suggest that first we need to find, before worrying about the cultural sensitivities, first we need to find people who want service and provide them good service. They will become good advocates. Next, we need to determine if there are real religious or cultural obstacles which hinder service. And if there are, then we mobilize leaders from those respective communities who can help address that issue. I believe firmly that the combination of authoritative information, champions, satisfied men and women in the community, and good service will move the program forward. Thank you very much, and I'm going to take the liberty of one more slide. I want to say, on behalf of the local organizing committee for the ICAP meeting, ninth ICAP meeting, which is going to take place next year in Bali, you are all invited. We hope very much that many of you will be able to come. I would like to suggest that we agree now, that we will talk then about what progress has been made on this subject. Thank you.
Thank you, Karen. And before I give the floor to Marge, who's going to be the last speaker, I want to highlight that when she finishes, we're going to open the floor for questions. There's going to be two ways of providing questions. One is for those of you that can get there, standing up behind these microphones to speak. An alternative is that you raise your hand and you'll be given a little card like this that will then be brought to the front. You need not wait till the end of March. You can raise your hand as she's speaking and the cards will get to you, I'm told. Thank you. March.
Okay. Thank you, Alvaro. Can you hear me? Okay. Good morning. My talk is on male circumcision, gender and sexuality considerations. Clearly, this is one of the hot topics of this AIDS conference, and I think that's terrific. Everywhere male circumcision has been raised, widely differing views have been expressed, and that means we can confront the issues and hopefully move towards some kind of consensus about it. My expertise is women's sexual and reproductive health and rights, including in relation to HIV. I'm not up here to condemn male circumcision, though some of you might think that that's why I was put here. I accept the reasons why it's being promoted and sought after. But it's early days to know what will contribute to reducing the HIV epidemic. And I am mindful of comments such as these regarding the very men who might benefit from male circumcision. And this comes from a UN news agency report last week, not from Reproductive Health Matters. My husband did not believe he could be HIV positive because he was circumcised. Many of the men I speak with think circumcision is like an AIDS vaccine. I don't want to give up, so I'm getting circumcised. But when top counselors would advise this young man that he would have to carry on using condoms even after the operation, he said, "If I have to wear a condom anyway, what's the point?" So here are some of the gender and sexuality issues that I believe male circumcision raises. First and most important is that partners of circumcised men have an equal right to protection. Male circumcision for HIV prevention is partially protective for HIV-negative men, but not for their partners, whether male or female, unless they also use condoms. It is the only HIV prevention intervention that does not protect both partners, at least to some extent. This is highly problematic. Male circumcision reduces population-level HIV transmission only after about 70% of the male population is circumcised, which is predicted to take up to 10 years, even in a highly successful program. A public health perspective says that 60% protection for circumcised men is far better than nothing where there is sexual risk-taking and unprotected sex. Many women and men in high HIV prevalence countries welcome male circumcision because they are desperate for something more. I am acutely aware that I am not in their shoes. I approach male circumcision as a women's advocate, and my question is male circumcision good enough for women? Not in 10 years' time, if herd immunity is achieved, but right now. Male circumcision is useless for HIV-positive men, tested or untested. What does this mean for their partners? If a man seeking circumcision refuses an HIV test, and he is circumcised, and he thinks he is protected, and he continues depositing semen in his partner's body every time they have sex, as I see it, his partner is in a worse condition and position than he or she was before. Ironically, male circumcision does not require behavior change in the man for himself, but for his partners to benefit, safer sex is still required. Therefore, equity needs to be created in other ways for partners. Safer sex is a way of thinking about and acting on sexuality, not just the activity of using condoms or having a bit of foreskin cut off. The promotion of safer sex has never received sufficient resources. The focus on male circumcision, ARVs, and other technical solutions is crucial to that failure. Could safer sex still succeed with a sufficiently renewed effort, or do we think deep down that it's impossible in practice? Because this is the question. If positive people are tired of protected sex and are giving it up, and if untested people are still engaging in risk-taking more often than not, then other prevention interventions are absolutely needed. But which ones? We need to get more sophisticated about what is appropriate for whom, including male circumcision. Are we going to circumcise men indiscriminately because they ask for it? We must insist, at the least, that HIV-positive men are not circumcised, and if for no other reason, because it's a waste of resources. This is a wheel that was presented at the last AIDS conference in the prevention plenary in Toronto. Several of these options, including vaccines, non-ARV microbicides, HSV suppression therapy, and mass STI treatment, are still far off or have been proven not to be effective. Thus, we are pretty much left with voluntary counseling and testing, behavior change, barrier methods, and male circumcision, but importantly also the growing potential of antiretroviral solutions. Male circumcision is 50 to 60% protective. If I proposed a contraceptive method to the world today that was only 60% effective, I would be laughed out of the room. But because there are so few solutions for preventing HIV, and the most effective ones are not accessible or not being used, less effective solutions have been found to be necessary. If we compare male circumcision to a cheap condom that will break 40% of the time, it won't sound quite so attractive, but maybe a lot of men who think it's a vaccine will understand it better in those terms. What about ARVs? Well, I say all praise to the Swiss. The equation treatment equals prevention means protection, not just for positive people on highly active therapy with low viral loads, but also antiretroviral prophylaxis. Prophylactic ARVs will take some years to develop and disseminate, but circumcising 70% or more of sub-Saharan Africa will take a long time too. When ARV options are available, what will happen to barrier methods, behavior change, and male circumcision? Look what happened to condoms for family planning when oral contraceptives arrived in 1960. There are short-term and longer-term perspectives to be had here. All right, what's the value of male circumcision? Male circumcision has been practiced for centuries by at least two of the world's major religions and many cultures for hygienic, initiation, and other reasons, and has been shown to reduce certain STIs in both partners. I have to say that if, as a woman, I don't think men have the right to tell me what to do with my body, I don't feel I have the right to tell them what to do with theirs. However, this is also about men as sexual partners and about social norms for sexual relations. And as with safer sex and condom use, if most people don't do it, the public health impact of male circumcision will be low. So how many men will do it? That's my question. This is a gamble, especially for women, and it's too large a gamble in the absence of other protection. In discussions of this issue, I'm struck by the concerns expressed by women's health advocates and how diverse they are. These concerns must be acted upon. I want to ask whose input was sought before programs began. Most of the interventions for fighting HIV were either invented by or widely advocated and supported by people living with HIV. Have those organizations of key populations, especially women, MSM, and sex workers, been involved in this? Why were women not consulted till after the train left the station? Can we really be asked to acquiesce in the imposition of a top-down, narrow, vertical prevention intervention 25 years into this epidemic? We deserve better. We need something that will work. How to assess male circumcision programs? This is a list of some of the things we need to know about how male circumcision is playing out in real life as it's provided. How many men? Where? Who? Younger, older, married, single, socioeconomic status? Why did they seek circumcision? What were their partners' views? How many men were tested and found to be positive? How many were negative? And what is their status several years down the line? Not one, not two, but five, 10. How many commenced sex before they healed? How many complications do they have? What kind? Have they changed their sexual behavior? Are they using condoms? How many had STIs that were treated at circumcision, and how many have STIs now? What was the HIV status of their partners at circumcision, and how many became positive since? What difference has circumcision made? So monitoring evaluation need to include far more than just how many men have had the SNP. Here are some proposals about involving women centrally in the rollout of male circumcision. First of all, programs should be for men and their partners, including information, couple counseling and testing, and promotion of safer sex to couples. And that also includes extra support for women in negotiating safer sex. Secondly, as women's health advocates, at a policy-making level in countries, and as advisors on including partners in service delivery. No one is going to pull out the red carpet for women's involvement in male circumcision. It's up to women to insist on this in our own countries and to ensure that women at community level have the information to be able to take their own decisions. We need more resources to increase grassroots programs for women on sexuality and sexual relationships. Women have to stop being victims and stop being described as victims in this epidemic. There are positive women in discordant couples. Many women also have more than one partner. Women are having unprotected sex and rejecting condoms, not just men. And like men, women have to confront these realities and their options. Finally, some conclusions, and I have 45 seconds left. Prevention needs major investment, and especially condoms and antiretroviral prophylaxis, in my opinion. It seems that male circumcision will not suffer from lack of funds. Priority setting at country level may or may not include male circumcision. Where it is included, if it gets more people practicing safer sex, then all those SNPs will have been worth it. But the SNP alone won't do it. There must be a link between the penis and the brain. Partners of circumcised men have an equal right to immediate protection. And safer sex promotion is needed now more than ever. So let's call for the Pleasure Project to open an office in every country. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marsh. I'm going to now ask those that, and thanks to all panelists, actually, for sticking to time and making sure that there is enough time to field questions. Please line up behind the microphone, and I'll be taking questions three or four at a time and then giving the panel the chance to answer. Before I give the first person the microphone, let me just address one question that has come in repeatedly through the cards, which is around why there wasn't a panelist here to discuss issues of MSM and male circumcision. I'd like to say on behalf of the organized that was precisely the title of the presentation that Manuel Velandia was going to make had he been able to be here with us. Please, we'll start here. Please introduce yourself and your organization.
Yes, good morning. Thank you very much for the opportunity. My name is Georgianne Chapin, and I'm here with a coalition, International Coalition for Genital Integrity. You might have seen our booth in the exhibit hall. Essentially, we're a group of people who have been working against medicalized male infant circumcision in the United States for about 30 years and have made enormous progress, and we've mobilized around this issue principally around many of the issues raised in particular by Marge Bearer and some of the other panelists in other ways. I have one comment and one question. One of my comments is that despite some really excellent points about the reservations around male circumcision, no point at all has been made of the value of the intact male body and the value of the foreskin and the value of leaving people as we promote with anti-female genital alteration. The value of leaving people the way they are born, natural sexuality, natural body parts. And that has not been in the dialogue at all, that perhaps the penis and the foreskin has more of a value than something just to be so-called snipped off. And I challenge anyone who's seen a circumcision to really call this a snip. This is an invasive surgery. My question is, given that the massive resources of the international health organizations have already been placed on this train towards circumcising males. And in fact, the previous session this week even called for spreading the intervention to infants in sub-Saharan Africa and then getting to other parts of the world. What can we who believe that all of these cultural issues are valid, that women's empowerment is a critical part of this, we're all at the grassroots level. What can we do to slow down this train and call for a more sensible, a comprehensive look at what we're actually proposing?
Thank you.
Thank you.
And can I ask, there's about 12 people lining up, and about 40 questions here. So if I could ask you to really not make another presentation, but a question to the panel.
Oh, my next question. Oh shoot. So, I've been listening to a lot of cultural.
Can you say your name and
the yeah, answer. Sorry. My name is Rick Perot. I'm from the United States. I've been listening to a lot of cultural and religious reasons for circumcision, but I have heard not enough or even nothing in terms of the empirical evidence that would substantiate circumcision. So that's my question. What evidence is there?
Okay.
Mine is really a comment, and I hope it's well accepted. The comment is just to say I applaud Marge. I think you raised some very valid questions and gave direction on what we should be doing. And just to mention that WHO and UNAIDS are actually looking at this issue about male circumcision and the implications for women. We've already had one consultation in Africa, and comments and suggestions like Marge's are what we need so that we can actually get suggestions, further suggestions as to what we should be doing. And also just to address some of the issues, we need to be consulting with countries. We need to be consulting with people within countries. That's what we should be doing. We need to let others in countries have their voices heard. Again, the WHO, UNAIDS, that's what we're doing. We're going to countries, we're facilitating stakeholder consultations, and we're consulting with countries and their governments as to what they want to do, not what others think they should be doing, but as the decisions they want to take to improve the health and the lives of their own people. Thank you.
Thank you. Before asking the panel to respond to these comments, can I add two questions that are coming from the cards also? One is a couple of questions here more or less saying, well, we've known that it works for a long time. Why haven't we implemented earlier? You might want to react to that. Somebody might want to comment on another question that's come a couple of times, which is around male circumcision and its role in multiple concurrent partners and how, if we look at it in that context, it might have an effect in women. Thank you. Any of you want to react to this?
Yes, if I may say, within the cultural context, it's most of the time actually sort of encouraged for males to have more partners. And within that context, we do have a problem of implications for women. But I believe if we have a very sort of strong gender transformative programs that go with the medical circumcision, we can be able to actually show men that they actually still have to take care of themselves and protect their women and their partners as well.
I think a couple of the questions may not be totally appropriate for this particular group of panelists, but the proof that it's effective was presented by Alvaro at the beginning of this session. There were three randomized trials that showed public health effect, so I don't think we need to go over that again. Why wasn't it done earlier? I think because those randomized trials were considered necessary, and a consensus meeting by WHO and UNAIDS was also considered quite necessary. There are lots of HIV interventions that have been implemented a lot longer after they should have been, so this is no exception. I think the question of multiple concurrent partners is an extremely important one, and I think that my presentation actually explained why that was so important, and why safer sex with male circumcision remains extremely important. The only issue is going to be reaching those partners, I think, through the index man who has been circumcised. And I think this is a major challenge for programs.
Karen, do you want to add? Okay, we'll take more questions.
Is Dr. Marshall D'Souza. I practice medicine in Fort Myers, Florida, United States. My question is to, and by the way, thank you very much for the panelists for an enlightening discussion. My question is to Alvaro. You made a statement at the beginning. Can you qualify that statement for me? You said there is no direct benefit to women from circumcision. It is very well known there are many benefits to women from circumcision and also to men. In those countries where circumcision is practiced as a religious ritual, incidence of cervical cancer is very low. And celibate nuns who never have had sexual intercourse, in them cervical cancer is unknown. Male circumcision is known to reduce the risk of penile cancer and beside reducing sexually transmitted diseases. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. And if that's what I said, I do apologize. What I meant is there was no direct protection from HIV transmission.
My name is John Geisiger, the executive director of the international children's charity Doctors Opposing Circumcision, based in Seattle, Washington. And my members around the world want to ask the panel a fairly simple question, once I phrase it. We know that the circumcision industry in the United States is a $1 billion industry in the initial intervention. However, it is also a $2 billion industry in the follow-up care, the infection issues, botches, redos, and any number of problems that I could mention to you. So my members would wish to know, what allowances have been made for the follow-up care of Africans who might volunteer for circumcision, and what follow-up care will come to those infants for which we believe that this is a stalking horse, the adult male circumcision campaign, for a later campaign for infants? What provisions have been made for follow-up care for those infants? Thank you.
Thank you. I'll take one more.
I'm too long. Thank you very much. My name is Lucy. I'm from South Africa, from city of Tshwane, the former Pretoria. I'm from the rural area. I'm a mother, I'm a grandmother. I'm a community worker. I just want to highlight something, because I heard the chairperson says we mustn't elaborate further. The panel have done that. But I think it is relevant and important to come with some of the solutions so that maybe in our experience that we had, some can address some questions that have been raised before. In our area, all initiation schools where are in mountains are registered. You can't operate without registration. And then number two, there is a public participation whereby there is a bylaw who must be implemented by the council itself at local level. And then in our culture, if you are not from the mountain, you can't talk anything about the initiation schools. Therefore, in that public participation, the stakeholders will be the traditional leaders. It will be the officials from environmental health. It will be politicians, medical doctors, and police. And those people are the people who are from the mountain, not each and everyone who will go and participate at that by law. And therefore, if there are bylaw transactions, there are fines. There are constant monitoring of those initiation schools by this team that I have mentioned. And then we do have challenges whereby there are mushrooming of initiation schools. And then there is a time frame. You can't open an initiation school before you finish 3 years. It's a bylaw. And disruption of school children during school days is also a challenge. Uncontrollable behavior from those children when they come from the mountain is also a challenge. And then I think I'll come with my proposal here as a way forward. That Mohomuzi, with due respect, my dear brother, I believe you are from South Africa. And therefore, We need more coordination from provincial level and local level. And we must develop a charter for initiation schools. I think all those challenges will be. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Okay, I'm going to give the chance to the panel to react. I want to add two questions, one of which is directed to Marge, and it basically says, have we given up on condoms and safer sex? The other one is somebody who writes, as a circumcised adult male, I believe that long-term trauma may have resulted from my circumcision performed shortly after birth. My question is there an understanding or sufficient understanding of the long-term emotional and psychological trauma as a result of newborn male circumcision?
I would just like to respond to the mother from South Africa with due respect. I acknowledge what the government has done so far to actually regulate around traditional circumcision. But you mentioned exclusivity in the gatherings, you know, from people who are not circumcised. And I believe for us to actually reach desired goals, we need to involve the other voice or the opposition voice as well of people who are not circumcised. And we need to make sure that in these communities, young men have the chance to have their own consent, whether they would like to circumcise or not. Already by saying only circumcised men are allowed in these meetings or only circumcised people means that we are already setting a stigma and discriminating. We're actually saying the same thing, that if you're not circumcised, you cannot participate in that gathering because you're not respected as a man. So I think within the same circumcising communities, there's people who would choose not to, and parents who would choose not to circumcise their sons. And another question to throw back at you is that what impact or what role do we have to play in the curriculum that is actually taught in the circumcision schools? Because I didn't hear you mentioning anything around that, and there's no regulations around the curriculum that the boys actually learn at the school. So I believe we need to start working with our gender components and other government initiatives to help actually strengthen their curriculum and make the men or the boys turn to better men who respect women, respect themselves, and who are faithful to their partners. Thank you.
The question, have we given up on condoms? My personal answer is absolutely not, quite the contrary. And I don't think we should ever give up on condoms, but it has been consistently my impression through the last few AIDS conferences that condoms are probably the least discussed topic in the conference. I went to a female condom workshop last night. It took me half an hour to find it. It wasn't signposted. It was in the basement somewhere where all the international agencies are hiding. And there were only about 15 people there. And at the last conference, I went to a UNFPA condom session, and there were 50 people there. And tonight there's a condom session at 6:30 when everybody's going to be out having a meal because it's over. So, you know, have we given up as a community working on HIV, on condoms? Do we get enough money for condom promotion? Do we get enough support for the social marketing organizations like Population Services International and DKT Marketing to promote condoms in countries? No, we do not. We probably have more money for everything else except condoms, and condoms are the here and now of prevention, which I have been saying and many people have been saying for the last 25 goddamn years. So let's get out there and promote the things, and let's get proper money to do it, and let's get an organization that is devoted to it. Do you know how many people are working on condoms at UNAIDS? I hate to tell you, so I won't, because it's probably not more than one. So let's get on with this, and let's demand money for condom promotion in a really, really important way.
Darren, do you want to react to any of the other comments? Okay. Go ahead.
See? And perhaps you could translate after, if you would be so kind. My name is Maria Cristina Alvarez de Gregori. I'm a physician and an anthropologist. I'm concluding my doctoral thesis at the Autonomous University of Barcelona, and my thesis topic has to do with genital motivation in both male and girls. I have a question.
On female and male genital mutilation.
Thank you.
My subject has to do with critical anthropology, and my question to the panel has to do with the issue of the naturalization of male circumcision. Throughout the Congress and all the previous sessions, we have witnessed a constant mix, a blend between religious values, cultural values and medicine, rituals and medicine, and so on and so forth. And within this process of naturalization of culture or medicalization of culture, circumcision of a ritual sort is evaluated. In Spain, lately, we have witnessed the death of two newborns after 8 days because of a ritual circumcision. If this had happened in the case of a girl, it would have been a true scandal. But since this happened with a boy child, and this seems to be a medical prescription, this has not reached the papers, only on the back of columns on the last page. I would like to see what your opinions are in this connection.
Around the medicalization and normalization of medical of male circumcision, the sort of denial of its religious value, cultural value, and others associated to it. Maria Cristina was giving the example in Spain, where she comes from, where very recently two babies under 8 years, 8 days old, died from being circumcised, a ritual circumcision. Because they were boys, it only occupied a third of a column in some third-class paper. Had they been girls, it would have been all over the front pages. So Maria would like also to look at the reaction of the panel to that.
Hi, my name is Seth Rosenblatt. I'm from the Center for Communication Programs at Johns Hopkins University. And I had a question. First of all, I'd like to thank you all for this panel. I was curious if program managers and clinicians looking to scale up male circumcision programs have looked at the experience of male sterilization programs and vasectomy promotion programs. We know in sub-Saharan Africa, male sterilization, even though it's an effective and cost-effective method and has few complications, is less than 1%. And there just seems like there's a similar array of problems in terms of changing gender norms and cultural norms. So it seems like it would be good to have lessons learned from that and the scale up of male sterilization as one of the only male-directed or male-initiated family planning methods has not been successful. So I'm wondering if there's been any look at that in terms of male circumcision. Thank you.
Thank you. One more, please.
I'm Marie de Senival from SIDAction, a French organization. We heard yesterday at a presentation by Bertrand Auvert that the rate of acceptance of male circumcision from the men who are being offered such a procedure was very high. It was like 80% in this clinical trial. But what was not said was that the rate of acceptance of the test in those same men was ranging between 15 and 30%, which is very low. And so that's a concern to us. Even though they might have good reasons, like fear of discrimination, lack of treatment and care, etc. My question, I guess, is for Supreme. In South Africa, do we have better rate of acceptance of tests in other programs? What can we do to make it better in this environment in Orange Farm? What can we do to improve the acceptance of testing inside a circumcision program, because we don't want to have all those people circumcised when they don't want to know about their status.
Thank you. And now in opening the answers from the panel, there are several questions that have come in, some to Karen, others to the rest of the panel, saying, well, if your answer to the question is yes,
At what age should male circumcision happen, and who should do it?
Okay, I'll just take the recent question from my sister from France. I would just like to say in South Africa, as the Men as Partners program we've just launched not long ago, a VCT mobile testing unit that actually is male targeted and male friendly. Some of the reasons that men do not wish to test is because of the stigma and discrimination that they experience in their cultures, communities, and also within the health systems themselves. We need to make sure that the clinics that we have where males are being tested are male-friendly. We need to ensure that there is support for males who do test positive. And we need to also work with the families and the communities from which those men come from to help them to be more supportive, because you tend to get more support as a woman if you test HIV positive than as a man. So what I would like to say is that, yeah, we should have male-targeted, male-friendly VCT services and give the benefits for testing, because most of the time it seems like for men there's no benefits, I will know and I will surely die. So we need to start changing that conception through programs. Thank you.
I'll just say very briefly that in terms of the lessons learned from vasectomy programs, I think that's an extremely good suggestion for people involved in male circumcision. I don't know if that's been looked at, but I certainly think it will be taken up now that it's been suggested. As regards age of male circumcision and who should do it, I think this is a very sensitive question, and it's an area of this topic on which there is possibly the least agreement around, and it might be extremely important for WHO and UNAIDS to actually call a meeting that looks at that question exclusively and tries to get some resolution on that topic.
I would echo what Majbera has said. In terms of the issue of age, and certainly there are different issues that need to be looked at the two different ends of the spectrum that have been discussed, which is whether we're talking about infant circumcision or whether we're talking about adult males, which is certainly what the most frequent discussion has been about more recently. In terms of who should do it, obviously there have to be local decisions made about that, because that will vary to some extent. But there does need to be agreement about standards of the health outcomes. There may be very different ways of achieving those positive health outcomes that one is looking for. There may be a place where there are traditional circumcisers who can be trained and it can be done very well. There may be places where that is not an option. There may be places where there are nurses who would be appropriate, but there needs to be agreement about who is responsible for setting the standards and who is doing the follow-up. Somebody previously raised a question about follow-up. I think that's a very good issue. I would add that I 100% endorse the comments that were made about the importance for giving additional attention to the issue of condom promotion. This is a thing indeed which is going to reach more people with more benefits to more people. One of the things that needs to be done, I believe, related to the circumcision issue in different locations is looking at the payoff, looking at the cost effectiveness, that it is available, that it is included in a comprehensive package, yes. Whether or not enormous amounts of money are invested in a large-scale program, I think that's a very different issue, because that then is an issue of, okay, we're going to use resources for this and not for that. And I think that is a very different issue that needs to be weighed heavily at something more further down the system than the global level. The global can't make that decision for different countries, different communities.
Thank you. There are six people lining up right now. That means we're going to try and take those six and no more from there and a couple more from in here. But in order to do that, you have to be very, very brief so I can then let the panel give some concluding remarks in response to your questions. Please.
Yes, Veronica Nozeda, Sidaction France. A couple of days ago, I heard a WHO representative who's just behind me, Kate Hankins, raise a lot of concerns about the reduction of transmission through heart in the developing country, especially because of the possible misunderstanding of the message. And we raised those concerns about circumcision, and Kate Hankins is very keen on circumcision. So my question is, are African men good for circumcision or not good for treatment?
Well, good timing there in the queue.
Kate Hankins from UNAIDS. Just to reply to that thing, we are very much in favor of ART for prevention, but in order to make that work, we're going to have to increase access to viral load testing. We're going to have better STD treatment. We do not want a north-south difference in terms of the use of ART for prevention. And that allows me to say one thing that I wanted to say about male circumcision, and that is that we're talking about combination prevention. We've been talking about it the whole conference. It has to be additive. It has to be increasing the choices for individuals and couples. It can't be replacing things. So I think all of us have got to get clearly on message, and that will apply as well when we see what happens with ART for prevention. I just wanted to clear up one thing. In Marge's presentation, Marge, you said that there would have to be 70% coverage for any effect. We've had six modeling groups come together, and already at a 5% coverage in the beginning of scale-up, you begin to see population-level effects. So there's not some threshold of 70% you have to get to. And finally, I'd like to just say there's a late-breaker session today at 4:30. It's in session room 11. And it will be providing information, more long-term follow-up information from Orange Farm, 42 months of follow-up, looking also at HPV and trichomonas. Thank you.
Okay.
My name is Longondo Eteni from the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Speak up a bit.
I am Longondo Eteni from the Democratic Republic of Congo. I've heard about the fact that the male circumcision reduces the transmission of HIV and AIDS. But I did not hear about the mechanism, how the actual removal of the foreskin reduces the transmission of HIV and AIDS. Does it have to do with the anatomy of the foreskin or other things? Thank you.
Okay.
Wait. Good afternoon. My name is Kelly Curran from Japaigo, and many of you may know that we've worked very closely with WHO and UNAIDS to develop a reference manual on male circumcision under local anesthesia. And I just wanted to address the question about age, because I think this is a very important question. And the title of the manual is Male Circumcision Under Local Anesthesia. And we at Japaigo feel very strongly that male circumcision should be provided under local anesthesia, and that elective male circumcision should be done under local anesthesia rather than general anesthesia. And that has a lot of implications for the age at which the person can be served. So we wanted to make that clear, that this should be under local anesthesia, not general anesthesia, which may rule out some certain age groups of children who would be unable to sit still for a male circumcision procedure under local. Thanks.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Paul Purcell, Gender Health. We're one of the organizations that's supporting rollout of male circumcision at the country level right now. And believe me, a lot of the challenges that have been identified today are things that we're coming up against. However, I believe that that's no reason to prevent us from moving forward. And we have to ensure that we do it in a way that safely and respects the rights, values, and beliefs of individuals. A couple of other challenges that have come up with, we've come up against at the country level that I didn't hear addressed are how to engage traditional religious leaders. And I was wondering if Karen and Supreme can maybe comment on that. And the other one is the potential for MC to stigmatize potentially HIV-positive men. And I just wanted to come back to your comment that Marge made about it shouldn't be a procedure offered to HIV-positive men. I disagree because of the potential to stigmatize, and I was wondering if you could comment on that. Thanks.
And just to add, Marge, when you respond, there's also been several questions coming in on the same issue saying if male circumcision protects against STIs, why shouldn't it be performed on HIV-positive men?
Good afternoon. I'm Tim Farley from World Health Organization, working with my colleagues on the implementation of programs and the normative issues. I would just like to say that these discussions that we've heard today and the comments that have been raised and the concerns are extremely important, and I welcome and I congratulate the organizers for having this particular session. But I would also like to emphasize a point that Kim made early on, that we need to have these discussions at regional, at country, at community level. That's where they really belong, and we would like to enroll the help of all of you in facilitating those discussions at the level where it really has to take place. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And now if I can have a final comment from each of you, but pretty quickly, we've got 4 minutes to go.
Just on the question on how can we involve traditional leaders, like I'm from Engender Health, and we believe that life should be healthy and we promote health. So I acknowledge that some aspects of culture are not healthy, and I think that's the focus that we can use, though, with the approach of cultural sensitivity, also acknowledging that there is some aspects of culture which is good and that should be maintained and that can be used. And actually, we're working on developing a program or a project that's called IKS, which is Indigenous Knowledge Systems, because there are a lot of good things within Indigenous cultures that are very good and that can be used to promote more healthy lifestyles. But then it's important for us to look at the aspects that are not healthy as well and look as to how can we improve it and not try to be a sort of international foreign people coming into the culture and saying this doesn't work, this is the solution. Yeah.
To Kate, the 70% figure I thought came from information in last year's consultation. If it's actually not correct, I'll stop putting it about. I apologize. On the question of Paul's question of stigma for HIV-positive men, I think this is a very important question. I don't have an answer for it, but I do believe that HIV-positive men need to get together and address this question and figure out something on this subject that's relevant, because I don't think that circumcision is the answer to preventing stigma. I think it has to be dealt with somewhere else and in some other way. And I suppose my final comment would be that I hope all the Americans in the audience go home and get the United States government to take the restrictions on condoms out of PEPFAR, and that all the Catholics in the conference go home and start working with Catholics for a Free Choice to get the Vatican to change their position on condoms, among other things. And I won't be at the closing tomorrow, but I hope somebody will stand up and propose that the conference supports much greater attention to condoms in the next conference, including in plenary sessions and in main sessions and in discussion sessions like this, where people have a good chance to participate. Thank you.
The question that was raised was involvement of religious leaders. In my most recent experience in Papua, there were two things that got the attention of religious leaders and opened up then dialogue with health providers, with many different people, to begin to develop programs. The first was when their congregation began to die, and they said, there's some kind of problem, I'm burying more people than usual. And several of them have said that explicitly. That was what made them begin to think. The second thing was a very interesting biobehavioral surveillance that was carried out. That data was gathered at the end of 2006, 6,300 people, and it was the first time when we began to use that information. That also caught people's attention. They said, These are our people. These are not Africans. These are not Cambodians. These are our people. And immediately, it changed the dialogue. This was biobehavioral surveillance of general population, the first time it had been done between the age of 15 and 49. So that got people's attention. I would be happy to talk further with you about the kinds of activities that were follow-up, but indeed one of the largest Protestant churches ultimately changed the curriculum in their seminary to include more information about reproductive health, HIV, to begin to look at issues related to gender. They have prepared materials for their ministers. They are providing training to all of their ministers, also training for pastoral counseling. They have paid for more of this activity themselves than they have sought from other people. They have sought technical support, and the woman minister whose picture I had has been one of the driving forces of this. She lives somewhere else. They invite her, and they then pay all of the training costs. So the use of local information is one of the ways to get the system moving. And in connection with that, I would say one sentence further, which is somebody was talking about the importance of getting the more discussion of stakeholders at the national level. I put in a plea for the subnational level. The national level is too high in most countries, at least in large countries, so that it needs to be multi-level if one is really going to have the impact we're trying to have at the community level. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you to all the panelists and to everybody that's filled this room. I was very nervous having to chair this session, and a colleague told me, don't worry, provided you don't tread on anybody's foreskin, you'll be okay. So if I have, I do apologize. But otherwise, thank you for having been here. And as you leave, please listen from a final announcement from Supreme.
I would just like to invite you to a session happening tonight between 6:30 and 8:30. It's the Men Engage, Boys and Men for Gender Equality, where actually this issue will also be dealt with in detail. Men Engage is developing a global movement for work with boys and men for gender equality. So I would like it to be there. It's in session room 7, 6:30 to 8:30. Thank you.